back to the podcast. This week we're joined by Gary Owens, who comes to talk to us about his lockdown-inspired pinhole project called 24 Secrets, and also his ongoing work called In the Room. Enjoy. Hello, and welcome back to the Lensless Podcast. It's show 138. And I'd just like to thank our previous guest, who's actually back again, is Mr. Holger. And he's joining us again in a moment. We'll chat with Mr. Holger momentarily, but we thanks for bringing us up to date on all things Holger Week.
Sure thing.
Last time around. And so we're joined once again by John Farnham from sunny Scotland. How are you doing, John?
I'm good, mate. I'm good, but not so much the way of sudden. It's raining all day.
Yeah, no, it's pretty miserable. It's pretty miserable down south as well.
Yeah.
And all the way from the land of the big hat and oil is Mr. Holger. How are you doing?
Hey, howdy.
Howdy indeed. Well, it's good to have you both back on the show. So you're still on probation, so we'll see how you go. Not had any feedback at all from the Lensless Podcast Facebook group, so either no one listens or they just don't care.
No feedback is good feedback.
yeah, indeed. So we're also joined by, Gary Owens, who just does some beautiful work. And we're going to talk to Gary about his work as an art teacher and his pinhole projects. Gary's been posting into the Lensless Podcast Facebook group recently with some of his constructed images with figures on beds and so on. So if you've seen those, you'll know exactly what we're talking about. Will, how are you doing, Gary?
I'm fine, Andrew. Good. Nice to be here.
Well, it is. It's lovely to have you. So just before we launch in and spring and turn the big spotlight on you, Gary, I hope you're ready for the grilling we're going to give you.
Do my best.
I'll just have a few moments with these other two characters to see what they've been up to, because I always like, you know, America's so glamorous and far away. I like to hear what's going on in Texas. But you've been flying around in private jets, I see.
I have, and I'm ashamed to say that I actually had my Ondu 6x6 with me, and not a shot was fired.
No. Is that because you were gripping onto the seat for dear life in fear?
No, that's because I was traveling with a couple of VPs, and I didn't think it was appropriate to start taking pictures.
Oh, they would never have known. They don't know what a pinhole camera is, would they?
No, they probably don't. But it really was nice. It's so much better than first class.
Have you ever done any pinhole? All three of you, actually, I'll ask you, any pinhole photography on airplanes?
You know, every time I want to get out my pinhole on an airplane, I always have the wrong film in there, and it's like going to be like an hour exposure or something like that. I need to prepare and have something like 800 speed or something like that.
John, have you pinholed on an airplane?
Yeah, it's about the only place I haven't pinholed, but I did take out one of my pinhole cameras to wind it on, one of the Reality So Subtle ones, and it started clicking. And a girl next to me get really, really nervous. She's like, what is that? And I'm like, it's a camera. And she's looking at me like, you know, really? I'm like, it's a camera. I'm just unloading it. You know, but she wasn't convinced by that. So I rapidly put it away.
Gary, have you whipped out your pinhole on an airplane?
No, I'd be too worried about an air marshal leaping on top of me.
Yeah. I think I've set it up on that little tray in front of you and done a selfie for a while. And I don't know whether I can't ever remember seeing the negatives when I developed that roll of film. So maybe they didn't come out, or I've just filed it away somewhere.
John, those extra wires you added to your Reality So Subtle, that just didn't help.
It did not. Honestly, the girl was like, "Woo!" You know, I don't know why. You know, I mean, I look like a sane and sensible kind of guy, you know, but maybe that was a whole ruse then.
I have done quite a bit of pinhole photography waiting for airplanes, though, because it always seems like that's the best time to pull out the camera and take a picture of the plane from the terminal.
I tend to set it up in airports. It's been a while since I don't travel on business anymore, apart from driving around in a supermarket delivery van. But I don't go to airports anymore, but I used to, and used to leave it set up, just photographing people wandering around, you know, and no one ever challenged me.
No.
John, what have you been doing any pinhole photography in the bright, sunny Scotland?
As ever, you know, I managed to crack out a few cameras last week, using some lovely positive film, which I've been learning how to cross-process, kind of, in C41 and HC110, so it gives me a beautiful positive again, but without using the full positive kit. It's pretty clever.
Hang on, yeah, so I got the bit about cross-processing, so yeah. You're using transparency film, you're developing it in C41, then you said something else I didn't understand.
Yes, so I initially develop it in HC110, all right? Then I expose it to light for about 3 minutes, and then I redevelop it in C41, so just follow the C41 process thereafter.
And what does that give you?
Gives me a beautiful positive, but it's cheaper.
Cheaper than using E6 chemicals?
Yes. Yeah, it's cheaper than using E6 chemicals, and I've got the C41 chemicals there, so I think, well, might as well do it. It still gives me the lovely positives.
So are the positives indistinguishable from what you'd get with a E6 kit?
Insofar as I can see,
okay.
I've been re-exposing them in a daylight balanced light bulb. That's supposedly the key to it. Make sure your colour temperature's right.
Well, years ago, before I got into developing any kind of colour film, but when I used to read avidly about such things in various magazines, I'm sure the reversal process, the what we now call E6, it might not have been called it then, used to involve re-exposure to light as part of the process, and it's only in relatively recent years that the simplified E6 kits allow you to develop your transparency film without exposure to light.
Yeah, it's like magic, honestly.
It is. It's all wizardry, isn't it?
It is, and it's really there's something really organic about it, even more so than just developing normally.
So how long are you exposing to white light, and does it matter about how far you are away from the white light or the intensity and or duration?
Yeah, so I'm exposing the film for about 3 minutes, and that's me moving it backwards and forwards right up at the light and then flipping it over and exposing it. So just flipping, moving across, back, moving across, and keep doing that for about 3 minutes.
So you're holding this strip of film out and you're moving it across the light source?
Yeah, I am. Mm. And it's daylight balanced, so I've set it at what you would expect a bright, sunny day to be at, you know, the kind of Kelvin rate. Mm-hmm. I think it's about 51,000 or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay.
And it really is. It's like magic, honestly.
Hmm.
Yes.
Well, I might give that a go. I've got a couple of slide films sitting on the side here, and I've also got boxes of 4x5 slide film in the fridge. And I keep thinking, I'll just wait until I've exposed a load of this stuff and buy a kit. But there's nothing to stop me testing one or two sheets of this film and using your process, because I've got C41 kits and I've got some, not HC110, I've got I have got some HC110. No, I've got the Ilford version, you know, but it's probably the same.
Yeah, it's all the same. But this is what's made me do it. I've got a pile of, you know, positive film, and I'm thinking I'm never using it because I'm always saying I'll need to buy a kit, but then I'll need to expose loads at the same time. But I've been doing a lot more C41, so it's really good.
Hmm. Okay. Is this some areas that you've dabbled in, Gary?
I do remember developing slide film a long time ago, and as you say, having to get it out and hold it up to the light for a while.
Yeah, it was part of the process, wasn't it?
It was
back in the day.
Yeah, but I haven't processed anything like E6 for, you know, it must be 25 years minimum.
Do any color? Do you do any color shooting or
well, I was inspired by I think yourself and Corey. You were talking at some point about the kits that you can get. This is it, CineStill, I think it is. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And so I did. I thought, well, I'll try some color developing for the first time in a long time. And it was great. Worked out really well.
Corey used to do all his at room temperature and.
Yeah, the stand developing he was talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I tried that as well. You know, that wasn't as successful for me.
Was it not?
I didn't have the special touch, I suppose.
I've not done C41 at room temperature. I've always stuck to the times it suggests. I used to just do it in a kitchen sink, you know, with a bowl of hot water, and that was always fine.
Yeah.
And but since I was given the Jobo CPE, I use that. But for RA4 printing, which I taught myself a couple of years ago, I now do that at room temperature, and that works. I can't really see the difference between doing it at 38, 40 degrees and room temperature. Plus, each print takes 2 minutes instead of 35 seconds. Well, for me, 2 minutes is still not a long time, and it gives me a bit more time to think, you know, and to relax. So 35 seconds is always a bit rushed, I find, you know. But this is colour printmaking.
I'm hearing something might be coming out from Bellini in this area.
What area are we talking about now?
Colour paper. Not making paper, but to do with paper. All to be revealed in the next few weeks, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're full of secrets and surprises, aren't you? How do you know all this stuff? Is it just through... people whispering in your ear, or you just pay more attention to things than I do?
I pay attention and people whisper in my ear.
Yeah. My trouble is I read things and people tell me things and then I forget that I've been told stuff.
Oh, that's especially when I'm told things. They know I'm going to forget them.
Do you do any color developing or Michael?
I have done both the CineStill C41 and the E6 kits. You know, they work rather well. I didn't have any issues with them.
I've used a Bellini. Most recently, I've used Bellini. I've used the CineStill. I've used, what else did I used to get from Silverprint? The Technol, and I've used the Rolly kits. And I'm sure they're all much the same, really. But there's probably subtle differences, but you know they all produce great results. So if folks out there are thinking about diving into color developing, don't be frightened by it. Don't think you need to go out and buy a load of expensive cooking items to keep your water hot as well. You don't need to. Trust me, you don't need to. Anyway, Gary.
Yeah.
There we are. It's really lovely to have you. So. On your website, Gary Owens Artist, owensphoto.org, for folks who want to dive into Gary's work, we'll be sharing all your info and links to your site on in the Facebook group. So all it says here about you is, and I've lost it now. Oh no! It says I tell you what, because I can't find that now. Oh, there it is. I'm a UK-based artist, art teacher, currently working at West Lancashire College in the north west of England. So go on then, let's do this bit where we tell us all about yourself and give us your life story and tell us a bit about your love of pinhole photography. And I'll jump in with questions and bring in John and Mr. Holger as well.
Okay, yeah, I've been teaching since the mid-90s, originally just as a photography teacher at the same college. And back then, that was before digital photography, so it was all darkroom. And there seemed to be some kind of unwritten law that you taught photograms in the first week and pinhole photography in the second week. So whenever those classes would come around, I'd always find out a bit more about pinhole photography, make more cameras. I always enjoyed making the cameras right from the earliest days. And I bought all the books that there were on pinhole photography because there was about five back then, as my memory has it. And I started using the cameras and making lots of pinhole images. But then as my teaching's gone on, obviously digital photography appeared and that changed things. And I started doing a lot more digital darkroom teaching than darkroom teaching, as Photoshop used to coin itself as the digital darkroom. So over the last, I suppose, 15 to 20 years, the amount of darkroom teaching I've done has slowly declined. And I'm teaching a lot more digital, anything to do with digital art, illustration, animation, filmmaking, graphics, anything to do with the computer and to do especially with Photoshop. But then the pandemic happened in 2020 and I found myself at home, and I live in a first floor flat with no access to any outdoor space. So that first lockdown in the UK, which I'm sure you remember, Andrew and John, you know, it's pretty severe. We were basically just told to go home and shut the door and go out for 1 hour of exercise a day. Yeah, unless you were in the government, in which case you could do what you wanted.
Yeah. Well, no, we don't talk about politics on here.
No, fair enough. We'll move on.
Why not?
So I found myself just in my flat, and I had a walk-in cupboard that I'd use as a dark room intermittently. And I thought, well, I'm here. I'm going to make that back into a dark room, and I'm going to make some pinhole cameras, and I'm going to start making some work. So the pieces that are on my website, there's one called 24 Secrets that came out of the first or second lockdown. I can't remember which. And then I started another set of images called In the Room, which I'm still working on. And I just started experimenting. In the lockdowns, I must have made at least 40 or 50 pinhole cameras, just anything I could find that I'd think, oh, that could be a pinhole camera. And then experimented with them. So there's also on my website just some experimental images with different kinds of cameras that I've made.
So you got properly obsessed then during
lockdown? Yeah, I'd say so. You know, and I think it, in a way, it sort of suited what I was ended up doing, because I was kind of locked indoors and I had this dark room. You know, it's ideal, really. You know, you can just load your camera, take a picture, back to the dark room, load your camera, take a picture. You know, you can just while away a whole day taking photographs. But obviously, the challenge for me was, when am I going to take photographs of when I'm inside 23 hours a day? And that's where the two bodies of work have come from, really.
Okay, well, let's just hold that a moment. I want to just take you back to, so you said you started teaching photography in the mid-90s. I don't know, I'm staring at a picture of you, but I'm no good with AU, so I don't know where you were in your career at that point. But did you have a love of photography before the mid-90s?
Yeah. From when I was sort of late teens, so sort of late 1980s, I got my first proper camera for my 21st birthday. My parents very kindly bought me a Zenith SLR. And that was the sort of, you know, a bit of an impetus for it. And then I went to some photography classes, you know, at the local college. And in the first lesson, the teacher took us into the dark room and we made photograms. And that was the first time I'd been in a dark room. I'd read about dark rooms. I'd even started buying dark room equipment at car boot sales and things. And I went straight home to find a copy of Amateur Photographer, because I knew there were ads in the back for people that sold paper and chemicals. And I wrote a check and went to the post box and sent it.
This is brilliant, isn't it? For young people listening to this show, young people, this is how we lived.
This is how we lived, yeah.
I remember when in the UK First Call Photographic launched, and they advertised on the back of Darkroom User, which became Camera and Darkroom User. I wasn't sure how I felt about the publication when it became Camera and Darkroom User. I thought it was going to be full of camera reviews, which I didn't really have a lot of interest in, mainly because I couldn't afford them. But First Call used to advertise on the back, along with Camera Bellows in Birmingham. And of course, you'd have to ring them up, or you'd have to place an order by post. It was lovely because it was all fairly relaxed, wasn't it?
And it's like I say about the books. I mean, I saw the odd article in magazines, usually something to do with Justin Quinnell, I think, at the time, about pinhole photography. But, you know, you had to go and find the books.
Well, when you were talking earlier about the five books, I was frantically looking in my bookcase and I can't find it. There's that textbook that came out. It's on about edition 3 or 4 now. Yeah. We've mentioned it on the show before, and it harks back to the, you know, the early days of sort of popular pinhole photography in the 70s. Mm. Oh, there it is. Yeah, Eric Renner's book.
Eric Renner, pinhole. Yeah. I have Eric, that one. Yeah.
Yeah, so I've got edition, third edition. Do you, John and Michael, do you have that book? I don't know if either of you are book fans or technical books. Pinhole Photography, Rediscovering a Historic Process, Eric Renner.
No, I don't have that one.
No, definitely not.
This is probably, isn't it, Gary, probably the Bible when it comes to...
Mm, yeah.
It's accessible, you know, it's easy to read. It places pinhole photography in the art world, in its historical context. It goes into some of the early experiments into solography, and well, it's just really good. And if you can, issue 3 is really good. I think maybe issue 4 starts getting into digital stuff. I'm not sure, but I've got the third edition. It's published by Focal Press, and it's a super super book.
Yeah, there was a glossy one that came out called, I think it was called Adventures in Pinhole Photography.
Yeah, I think I've got that as well somewhere.
Yeah, which I really enjoyed that one. And that's how I learned everything, you know, because before the internet again, there was just...
That's what you did, wasn't it?
Yeah.
See, those books or those magazines, Darkroom User and Camera and Darkroom, they used to each month, I think it was monthly, they'd have a section on alternative processors. So I've got all these magazines. I was looking at them the other day, and this whole... detailed articles on like color types and gum over bichroma printing and all sorts of weird and wonderful things that I didn't fully understand back then, and to be truthful, don't fully understand now, but it's nice to, you know, it's nice to have the articles there. So John and Michael, you're learning, you're both old people, so how did you learn about pinhole photography? I've probably asked you both this before, but just remind me.
Sorry, I'm just trying to think. Old people, I love it.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah.
What's your learn? I tell you what. I'll rephrase the question. This is what's your learning style? Are you a doer, John?
Yeah.
Or do you like to read?
No.
When I mentioned pinhole photography, rediscovering a historic technique. See, I like to learn by doing, but I also like to back that up by reading about it. In other words, kind of immersing myself in the subject, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm a doer. I just like to go and make things.
Yeah.
I'll make anything.
Yeah.
I'm quite handy with wood and 3D printing.
You are, yes.
Yeah, so I'm comfortable just making things. But I do like books, you know, but I just like to look at the pictures. I'm really not...
Well, of course, yeah. You grew up in Scotland, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean,
the education system's not great.
Yeah, the education system here used to be really good, but we'll not get into politics. But talking about books, I've just got a new one from Steve Starr in my hand.
Oh, yeah. I haven't got that yet.
Yeah, so yeah. It's really nice.
Book on seaside shelters, basically.
Yes,
it?
Coastal Encounters. But I do like to look at the pictures of things in books, but I'm not a technical person. I am very technically minded, but I don't like to get involved in the technicalities of making things like pinhole, because I like the artistry to come through more than getting focused on the settings and the, you know, everything like that.
Okay. Michael, what's your learning style?
I think I just jumped in. I think I'm going back in memory here. I think the first pinhole I did was that pinhole camera that you could print on a piece of paper and fold it up. And I think it looked like a little 35 millimeter camera or something like that. None of my shots came out, but that didn't keep me from trying a different pinhole camera at some time. You know, I think ultimately that's how it is. I just jump in and start doing it.
Okay. So Gary, when you started teaching, and what age groups of people did you start teaching, and are you still in that same age group?
When I started, there was a lot more adult students. So I would teach qualifications to adult students, night times. We had Saturday classes at times. And then in the daytime, I'd be teaching mostly teenagers, sort of 16 to 19. And as time's gone on, it's got harder to run adult education classes. So my teaching now is pretty much entirely 16 to 19 year olds.
Right. So, and what element of traditional photography now in 2023 do you incorporate into your classes?
If the students are keen, if they're interested in photography, I try and take them through a sort of a process while they're with me, where we do everything: photograms, pinholes, 35mm black and white, film shooting and developing, 120 film shooting and developing, 5.4 sheet film, because we have all the cameras, we have a photography studio, we have a really nice dark room. So if they're interested, I try and make sure they get a really good grounding in traditional photography, if you want to call it traditional photography.
So are they there? I know you said that you're teaching all forms of media.
Yeah.
But are they there doing mixed media type studies, or is it photography?
They're really, it's a really small department. So the students, they have their own career goal, and that can be anything from filmmaker, fashion designer, anything, animator, graphic designer, photographer, you know, so it's a really mixed bag. So the courses are kind of tailored around the students. So some years I don't really have that many students who are that keen on photography. So, you know, there's not an awful lot of that goes on. I'm doing other things, but currently I think I've probably got about 4 or 5 students who are keen on photography. So whether they know it or not, at some point they're going in the dark room.
So do the dark rooms get used by community as well as college?
No, sadly, no. It's quite sad. You know, they're mostly sort of empty. I mean, it makes it a great resource for the students. I mean, I sometimes have students who go to university, but they have occasionally come back and said, can I use the dark room? Because it's quite hard to get in some of the university dark rooms, they've told me. So sometimes ex-students come back and do some work. But no, sadly, there's no kind of connection with any sort of community groups.
Do you find it comes under threat as being something archaic, you know, from the powers that be? Said, oh, why do you need to keep this?
Yeah. I mean, we're actually in a new campus that was opened in 2011. And I was one of the managers at the time. And so I was told that I would have input into the design of the whole art department and the performing arts department. Mm. So I was given a square meterage and I said I wanted a dark room. And the principal at the time said, that's ridiculous, you're not having a dark room. Because people who don't understand anything about art, and that's not their world, they don't get it. You know, they think everything's digital. They think there's no need for anything other than computers. So I was very fortunate. There was actually somebody visiting at the time who was a very famous runner of an art department who was just about to retire. And they knew the principal and they just said, don't be so ridiculous. Of course, there's got to be a dark room. So fortunately, I got a dark room. And it was quite interesting that it was hard to get the equipment, you know, because the things are dying out. The previous dark room was 25 years previously that we built it, and we got a bunch of Durst enlargers, the M670s. And then when it came to this new dark room, the quality of enlargers that you could find for sale is just nothing like the quality of the Dursts. And so I've ended up actually using the Dursts. I've been using the same enlargers for 25 years. And there's nothing wrong with them. They haven't aged at all.
Well, I suppose it immediately makes me think, I mean, Michael over in America there, he spends a lot of time at Don's Use Photo, and you get, you know, we have this sort of perception within our little film world. I hate to use the C word, community world, that film photography is really kind of trendy, and young people are, you know, desperate to get cameras, and we see it, don't we? We talk about prices going up and price of cameras and gear, and certainly there seems to be lots more interest in darkroom things online. From when I first joined Twitter in 2012, you know, there just seems to be a world of interest, relatively speaking, in our small world. I mean, do you see that with the guys who come onto your course, Gary? Do you see that at all?
Yeah, there is some of that. You know, it has kind of caught their imagination. I suppose what they would think of as being called experimental photography, I suppose that's the term we've ended up with, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sometimes they'll say to me, oh, I've just bought this amazing camera. And I say, okay, bring it in. And my heart always sinks because 9 times out of 10, what they've bought is a Kodak Instamatic.
Yeah.
You know, and they say, well, I want to take some pictures, and I think, oh,
yeah.
You know, but
if they'd have brought you a Kodak Cresta 3 or even a 620 camera, you could have worked with it.
Great, yeah. But no, it's usually an Instamatic.
But Michael, when you're spending time with Todd in the store there, or when you're in there, or when you're doing is his demographic, what is the demographic of his customers? Is it mostly younger folks these days, or is it still a mixture of old gray people like me and you?
Well, you know, the old gray people know exactly what they want, so they're always looking for those hidden gems that have been given away or something like that. But there are quite a few people who are getting their first SLR or point and shoot camera for the first time, and you know, Todd, bless his heart, is constantly showing people either one, how to use the camera, or most importantly, two, how to load the camera.
Yeah, but that's really important, isn't it? You know, because why would we, you know? For me, it's second nature, and for you guys, but for someone who's never picked one up before,
yeah, it's definitely that. I mean, I was very fortunate. So, I mean, Todd's having a lot of sales right now on a bunch of stuff. I actually got myself a 4x5 and larger now, and somebody donated me a darkroom sink. So my shop is going to be up and running, I hope, soon. So,
wow, very good. Yeah, I'd quite like a 5x7 enlarger if someone's got one they want to give me. Yeah.
You notice it went quiet there.
Yeah. Well, there's only you three. I don't suppose either you three are going to give me one.
No.
Just a question out there to the wider, the wider world. Anyway, Gary, 24 secrets. So secrets. Ah, okay. I get it now. So the 24 secrets was a project you started during COVID, and presumably were you being furloughed during this time?
Yeah, we did have to carry on teaching online.
Did you?
You know, but it was a lot less time consuming, I suppose, than actually, you know, going in and teaching.
Yeah. So you were looking around the home and for things to photograph. And why did you decide to use an old throat lozenge tin from the 1940s?
Well, I bought a box of random tins to make cameras out of.
Yep.
And when I opened it and I was going through them, I just literally read that as 24 secrets.
Yeah.
And sure. I just thought, oh, wonder what. And then I thought, oh no, it's sucrates. And I'd never heard of sucrates. But I just thought, it just sparked an idea. And I thought it would be nice to make that tin into a camera that I take 24 pinhole pictures with, and then the pictures live inside the box, and they're 24 secrets.
It's just a lovely idea, isn't it? I like the idea of using it as a storage facility as well.
Yeah. And so the gist of it, I mean, because I was in my flat, I was tidying, as we all were, I'm sure, and opening cupboards, and I'd been in a relationship that had ended, and I realized I still had stuff that belonged to the person. And I thought, well, what do I do with it? And I thought, well, I think I'll take photographs of it. So all of these photographs, they mean something to me and to that other person, but they wouldn't mean anything to anyone else. So they are essentially like a little box of secrets.
Yes, yes, beautiful. Does that include the half-frame camera as well?
Yes, yeah, that was a camera that I'd lent to that person to go and learn some photography with.
Wonderful, wonderful. So you what did you do? Where's the pinhole? I can't see the pinhole on this camera. Is it on the lid, or
I put it on the back. I didn't want to ruin the front because it was nice, the graphics.
Yep.
Yeah, and there's one picture of the actual tin, which I took with another tin. I did try taking some pictures of it, and it's in a mirror, but I wanted the front on the front of the picture, but the rest of the pictures are all taken with that little tin.
Mm-hmm. And you were doing it direct onto paper, I guess, were you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you using paper. Normal, regular multi-grade paper, or were you using one of the graded papers that Ilford used to make?
No, I'm multi-grade. Yeah, the only real things I can sort of get hold of. I mean, I have got a stash of old papers that I always worry about using. But no, I just use whatever kind of multi-grade I've got.
a lot of folks have been on the podcast over the years have talked about using paper negatives, and you know we've talked about it endlessly, and a lot of people have always said, oh, you should use if you can get it now, you know, the fixed grade, grade twos, grade one and a halfs, you know, the old paper. So yeah. John and Michael, let's just bring you in here first of all on the, you know, just on Gary's whole 24 Secrets project. We'll start with you, John, but also your experience with paper. We've probably talked about, I've probably asked you this before, but again, I can't remember what I did yesterday. So with multi-grade or with fixed grade paper, but what do you think of this little project of Gary's, and the idea of how just simple is this, you know, making pictures and then storing it in the tin?
Yeah, I think it's fabulous. It's just so good. I was quite transfixed by it when I first looked at it, and I just keep looking at it again and again. You know, I love things like this. Just it's like a kind of little itty bitty thing, and the process is done in the tin, and the tin is used to keep the paper in. It's just brilliant. Yeah.
But I like the almost cathartic. I don't know if I'm overstepping the mark by referring to this as a sort of cathartic problem, process. But to me, if I was doing this for the reasons that you've hinted at, Gary, it would be a way of sort of, you know, processing the relationship or the experience. Well, it doesn't need to be, you know, any kind of experience you have. You could take your secrets, your tin, on holiday and have 24 holiday snaps, couldn't you? It could be anything, really.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely, yeah. No, it certainly was a sort of a process of me thinking about, you know, that particular time of my life, and you know, thinking about what I could photograph, you know, and what would have that connection to that relationship.
If I could, I'm sorry, Gary, what is the size of the pin, the tin?
It's, I would say, probably about no more than sort of 10-11 centimeters across, I'd say. You know, it's smaller than a normal kind of tobacco tin. I use tobacco tins a lot.
You'd have to tell him in inches.
I'll tell him in inches. 3 inches, 3 and a bit inches. You know, not very large.
Okay, so for the US, that's about a 3x4 tin. That's a really nice size.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it's it was just a lucky find, you know, because I just, as I say, I just misread the front cover of the tin.
And you've got, it's a fairly shallow sort of focus because you don't get full edge to edge exposure, which is that's not a criticism, just an observation.
No, yeah. I'm quite fond of vignetting around the edges.
It's really nice. I do. I read it, you know, as Secrets straight away because I know Secrets. But it's I love the tie-in, Gary. See, just that you found something. And then you get developed a whole idea around about it, and they just ran with it. That just blows my mind. You know, I love that kind of stuff. And this is just, wow, I love it. I'm not a great fan of vignettes. I need to put that out there. But the vignettes, can I tell the story of the wee thing? You know, and can I put it in a wee package as well, if that makes sense? You know, it's lovely. What an idea. What brilliant.
Thank you.
Well, I think the vignetting and the way the tin captures the images is almost reminiscent of a sort of dreams and memories, you know. You know, do you think? Like, to my mind, that's what it conjures up, you know, images that you might see in dreams and memories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, go on, Michael.
You know, I love the tins, and you know the fact that this was 24 Secrets and Secrets. I mean, you know, because after the tin has been done used with whatever it had in it, people always store treasures in there, and you know to have it in a drawer at some time and rediscover it later, and to pull out these images. I mean, that's I like that a lot. That's phenomenal. So. Actually, very encouraging. I'd like to do this myself. I mean, because you know, Altoids tins are all over the place, and but to find an older tin like this is even nicer.
We had somebody on the show Yeah, oh, forgive me. We've had 138 shows. We've had somebody on the show, and someone will say, it was me, who went and found objects, tins.
Yeah.
Do you remember this?
Yes. And, it's a lady that does it, isn't it?
And they pick them up. Who was it who does it? And they turned them into cameras, but using the found objects.
Yes.
Who was it? I don't know who it was.
I can't remember her name either, Andrew. It's quite a while ago, but I remember being quite.
Was it Becky or?
Oh, I don't know.
Wasn't Astro Beck? Was it? I don't know. It might have been. Anyway, not to worry. So is this project? I mean, I can see that it's a complete project, Gary, but. Will you? Do you just not have the hankering to go and do this again for lots of other memory journeys?
Not so far. No, I mean, I might return to it, you know, as a way of working. But it was just a sort of serendipitous find, really.
Yeah,
and the idea just came, so I just went with it.
Okay, so then at some point. In the room started. How did that evolve? So we're in lockdown, which seemed to just go on forever. Various lockdowns. And then did 24 Secrets start after that period, or not 24 Secrets in the room? Sorry, after that period. And how did that? What was the genesis of that project then in the room?
Well, that was quite a long one, really. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen the work of an artist called Greta Stern. She was a German photographer who worked in South America in the 40s and 50s.
But I'd like to say that I'm sure the name's familiar, but then so many things are to me, but I can't place it, but I will do.
A surrealist photographer, right. Stern, Greta Stern.
Yeah.
And I've always liked her work, and a long time ago, probably at least 15 years ago, I was looking at her work, and a lot of it is photo montaging and then, you know, re-photographing the photo montage. But some of it looked to me, and I don't even know if it is, but some of it looked to me like she was actually printing figures, cutting them out, and standing them in scenes. So there's one image she has of a sort of an 8-inch tall woman with a vacuum cleaner vacuuming a bookshelf. And there's, you know, one image where there's like a desk lamp, but the central column of the desk lamp is an image of a woman. And they look like they're sort of miniature figures. And so that gave me the idea originally of using cardboard figures in photography, and I've done a workshop with students for at least 15 years where that's what we do. You know, it's a one-off workshop. We cut out some cardboard figures, take them outside around the campus, stand them next to Coke cans and trees, and stand them in the grass and re-photograph them, usually with a mobile phone these days. So I'd always played around with sort of cardboard figures, and then I don't know quite what it was. I mean, I suppose, you know, if I did analyze myself, it's got something to do with COVID and other things about this claustrophobic room. I suppose that's maybe where the genesis of the idea came from. But I decided to make a set and put things in the set, including putting figures into the set, and then start photographing it. And pinhole cameras are fantastic for that kind of close work, you know, this kind of claustrophobic work, or at least I find they are. Because I am literally building sets. You know, there's a floor, there's a ceiling, there's four walls. And often when I'm taking the picture, everything's in the set, including the camera. So I take the, you know, I expose the shutter, take the little cap off the shutter, and then put the lid on the box. And then they're all in there. And the only light that's coming in is light that's coming shone through the windows that I've cut into the set. Mm-hmm. So that's how they kind of started. And I started to work at 1/12 scale because I realized that that's a common scale for dolls' houses, and that meant that I could get furniture and windows, you know, that you can buy them. And I
was going to say, because you've got little chairs. Well, I mean, they look like normal chairs, but you've got furniture, haven't you? So they're dolls' houses. Okay.
Yeah. And so that's where that's come from, you know, and I'm still kind of pursuing it. You know, I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm just kind of going with it. I'm just image making, you know, and I sort of reflect from time to time, but.
Well, there's certainly surrealism in there. Yeah. There's sort of Norwegian film noir going on, and I only say that because I was just watching a documentary on BBC iPlayer from who was the Norwegian film director, the one who did all the black and white stuff in the 70s.
Oh, you mean Bergman?
Bergman, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's Swedish.
Yeah, Swedish. Well, Norwegian, Swedish, you know. Well, it's all the same, isn't it? And there's, but 1940s detectives, you know.
Yeah.
It's all there, isn't it? Yeah. And Agatha Christie, but maybe not so much. But certainly storytelling. To me, it's all very narrative and stories. And you can just look at each of these images and make up your own sort of story, can't you? Just before I bring in my two colleagues, Diane Peterson, who's a former guest on the show and pops up in the Lensless Podcast Facebook group. I don't know if you listened to that episode, Gary, but she's
may have done, yeah.
she's got what we refer to as a pinhole friends, I think. So she cuts out life-size
images. Oh, yes, I do remember. Yeah.
Like creatures with rabbit heads and all kinds of strange mannequins, and makes very beautiful images using these cutout figures. Not like what you're doing, but in that same sort of vein, you know?
Yeah, I love her work, yeah. She dresses them up and everything.
She dresses them up, yeah. No, it's brilliant. We'll have to get her back on again at some... I think she's only been on once, so... I'm very keen to catch up with a few of the guests that we've had on at some point and just see what they've been up to. Michael, over there in Texas, what's your thoughts on In the Room, or any questions you've got for Gary?
First of all, yeah, I was looking at the Greta Stern stuff. You're right. It is very reminiscent about it. I mean, essentially combining images. It's just it's playing with the perspective that we're normally going to see, which I know that just throws people off in such a way. Yeah. I think initially when I looked at your photos, because I saw them when they came across the Lensless podcast Facebook page. I initially thought they were cutouts, and I didn't really go into it other than I was thinking, okay, well, you know, something has been done here. It looks a little not normal, but it still could be done with a pinhole camera. I didn't know you were using doll stuff, though. That's a good take. I like that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've never, you know, I wasn't intending to fool anybody. I'm just making images. You know, I'm making pictures. I mean, it never crossed my mind for a moment that people would think, are they real people standing very still in a very long pinhole photograph? You know, because I would that I could get people to stand there for 10 minutes, but no.
I know, it's a long time. Yeah. And, you know, and whenever I take pictures of people out in the wild, I said, look, your picture is never going to be there. You're just not going to sit still that long. And they're like, okay, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, so are you pointing that camera at me in photograph? I said, it's a pinhole camera. They're not even going to see you.
Right.
You know, there's millions of people using iPhones and cameras just taking photographs randomly. You're being recorded pretty much everywhere. And I'm standing here with a pinhole camera and you're getting aggravated, really?
Yeah. You know? I think I answer more questions at the TSA check line because it's like, is that a wood camera? I said, yes, because I always have them hand check my film instead of scanning it. Is this a wood camera? Yes, it is. Where's the lens? There isn't one.
Yeah. John.
Yeah. I've got a question before we go on from the group itself, right? So Neil Dorman's asked, and this is on the 24 Secrets, he's asked if you're doing it as a contact print in the paper negative, or are you scanning and inverting, or how do you reverse process the paper?
Normally I scan in and print, you know, inkjet print, only just because of the control that you've got, you know, a little bit greater control over the look of the print compared to contact printing it.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. You know, contact printing's a bit of a dark art itself. I do love it, but it is easier, as you say, to do it on the computer and then basically print it out from there. But don't tell Andrew that, because he's quite a Puritan on these things. No?
Sorry, well,
keep it quiet.
Yeah. As I'm getting older, I'm less able to concentrate on more things at once. I was actually reading the dialogue that Gary's put on his site about In the Room, and I could hear you twittering on in the background, John. and then I heard my name being mentioned. What is it?
You suddenly focused back in again. What was talking about is Neil had asked a question about how the process works, whether it's reverse printed or whether he's reversing the paper negatives. And I says, I do, you know, tend to prefer doing the kind of digital hybrid. because it's easier.
Yeah, it is.
It's easier, but you being a wee bit puritanical with these things, you know, you would prefer to contact print it. But contact prints are beautiful as well.
They are. Yeah,
yeah, they are like little secrets all on their own, you know. That's how I get back into printing in the dark room, was literally underneath my stairs with curry pots, right? And then using my iPhone to contact print things. So it really kind of, this tiny little stuff, I love it. I absolutely adore it.
Yeah, I like small jewel like images.
Yeah, yeah.
And it helps when, you know, materials are so expensive, so if you can make tiny little jeweled like images, then it's a win-win, isn't it?
It is. I think you asked me a question and I didn't answer it about the fixed. Oh, that sounds like a big wolf of a thing. A fixed grade papers, Andrew.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I have piles.
Who's got the woofing dog?
I'm sorry. That's Sherlock. He's a head of security.
That's okay. No, it's fine. We love all sorts of animals, and we've had all sorts of random noises in the background over the years. It's fine. Hello, Sherlock. Can you hear me? Probably not.
Sherlock.
He does. He just doesn't like delivery trucks.
Okay. Does he like Tesco drivers? You have no idea what I'm talking about.
I do not know.
No. I got bitten on the bum within a few months ago, but that's another story. Tell us about your paper.
I've got piles of...
have you? Do you have cream for them?
Yeah, I've got really good cream for it. It's got some sand in it as well, which helps. You know, so yeah, I've got lots of fixed grade paper. I picked it up years ago.
Is it, do you find it easier to work with for paper negatives?
I like really high contrast anyway. So if it's anything below about 5, Andrew, I'm out. I like real contrast in my prints. And below that's wishy washy. But yeah, in the room, I love it. And I love I'm not a fan of the sprockets, but I do love the way they're done here. On the side, and just it's like it's in a doll's house, but it doesn't look like a doll's house at all. It looks completely real. It's just, yeah.
Well, I think that was, we're not going to dwell on it, but that was some of the confusion that was caused when Gary first shared these images in the podcast.
But I mean, the sprockets are from a Le Rouge. I don't know if you know, Andrew, but I bought your Le Rouge off you. You advertised it on Facebook a while back.
Well, we must have chatted back then, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so I tried the Le Rouge. All the circular pictures are taken with tobacco tins.
Yeah,
I have a set of 5 identical tobacco tins, and that's what I used to take those circular images. But the ones with the sprockets are the Le Rouge 135P.
Okay.
And I actually
wish I'd have kept it now.
Well. Well, I actually used that. I shot about 2 or 3 films with it. And then I shot it once doing this project. And I must have completely forgotten how to wind it on. I've done the same with Holger cameras, I have to admit. Yeah. And you're supposed to turn it a turn and a half every frame.
That's right, yeah.
And I must have forgotten. Either that or it's a faulty Le Rouge you sold me. I don't know. But I must have forgotten. Yeah. And when I took the film at the developer, I looked at it. I thought, this is just one long exposure. It was a meter long exposure with every frame, you know, on top of each other. So a third of each frame, I must have just turned the knob once rather than 1.5 times. A third of each frame was overlapping the frame in front and the frame behind. And I just thought, this is fantastic. And I just really liked the way that the frames were merged together. So I've been doing more of that with the Le Rouge. I'm not a huge fan of sprockets either. You know, they drive me mad sometimes. but they seem to kind of work with this. Yeah. You know, something about the filmic look of it, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it is. It's really in context in here because we alluded to sort of film, cinema, film noir, storytelling. Mm. And I think the sprockets kind of is a nod to that, isn't it, really?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and they help kind of push it in, don't they? Can I draw your eyes in?
Yeah, yeah. Because I'm not a fan of panoramic images either. Which... I know, I'm sorry.
Pick me up off the floor.
You know, but this, what it gave me, because I didn't know, I mean, the only problem with a meter long film, you don't know where to cut it or whether to cut it. And when you scan it, you don't know quite which ones, but it gives me an option because you can either, you know, with the frame to the right or the frame to the left, I can make some decisions about which ones have worked out best. And then that's where I make a decision. That's where I'm going to actually crop the image, because otherwise it would be a meter long by 35 mil image.
So you've embraced, so you rumbled me that I just sold you a dodgy LaRue camera.
No, I think it does work.
I'm thinking, Andrew, you did not ask for enough money. I mean, these are great shots.
Yeah.
Dodgy people, though.
I just can't be doing with 35 millimeter pinhole. I know John does it. And of course, our friend, Mr. Guerin, now makes a 35 millimeter sort of panoramic-y type pinhole camera where you don't have to just count one and a half turns because it's as we spoke about probably in the last or the one before that show when John was on, just being when we had the catch-up show, his latest one's got clicks, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
It does.
Clickety click, and that's what set the woman off in the plane. It was the clicking.
Yeah.
You know, she's just like got into a blind panic. So, yeah.
And it makes more efficient use of film because you don't end up with ever widening frame spaces.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. So Gary, let me just read what it says here. So this is a quote, isn't it? Yes. In the room, women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. So what's that from? Is that T.S. Eliot?
Yeah, it's a T.S. Eliot poem. Yeah.
And that's the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
Prufrock. Prufrock, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a series of images taken with homemade tobacco tin pinhole camera. My dad used to have stacks of these tobacco tin,
yeah,
which used to keep screws in and things, you know,
in
a drawer. So it's those, is it? So it's going to be a similar size to your 24 secrets.
Yeah, it's a little bigger. I mean, focal length, if I want to use the term focal length, it's about 23-24 millimeters, just a bit less than an inch. And it's actually almost identical to the LaRouge. I put pinholes in them for f/1.28. And it's the same as the LaRouge. The LaRouge gets no vignetting. Why does the LaRouge have no vignetting?
You say it's about the same depth, is it?
Same kind of 24 mil focal length. I've never understood that. I don't know whether it's just the purity of the pinhole that means the vignetting is not happening. But with my tins, I get a lot of vignetting. But with the LaRouge, seems to cover it without any vignetting. But anyway.
Mm. Well, if you've got the same focal length and the same pinhole diameter, then it should give you broadly the same coverage.
Same thing. Yeah, that's what I assumed, yeah.
Mm. But it speaks volumes of the top quality pinhole camera that I sold you.
It must be that.
That I've forgotten I'd sold you.
It's exactly that, yeah.
I've sold stuff to loads of different people, but I can't remember who they are. I've given
Andrew, are you selling any other cameras for cheap?
I've given loads of stuff away as well, but I can't remember what. If I've given you anything, just don't sell it on eBay. That happened once, but anyway.
It was a very good price, Andrew. Thank you.
Yes, I'm sure it was. So the room. When I do sell things, I don't tend to sell them for extortionate prices because I'd rather they went and. That's why I give stuff away, really, because I'd rather they just went to someone who can use them. But when times are hard, you know, then sometimes you just need to get a few bob for things, don't you?
Mm.
The room is populated by a mixture of figures from vintage magazines and albums. But now, this is a bit I didn't understand, but also
Hugh montages,
figures created using AI. Text-to-image making apps.
Oh, no.
So you've used the AI word there.
Yeah.
Tell us, let's just rewind. Vintage magazines. So are you on the hunt for vintage magazines all the time too?
Yes. There's people on eBay that sell them digitized. So I've got
literally
thousands and thousands of vintage magazines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you just buy, they used to be on DVDs, but now you just download them. Okay. So I'm especially fond of Hollywood magazines from like the golden age of Hollywood, the 20s, 30s, 40s. But also things like Life magazine and National Geographic. I have another aspect to what I do, which is digital montaging, which is also on my website in the digital bit, but I use those kind of materials for that. And I also collect family albums. So
Just going in like a charity, in like an thrift store for our American listeners and finding stuff that.
Yeah. Or, you know, these days, the thrift store of the world, eBay. You know, sometimes you can buy job lots, sometimes you can buy half a dozen of them at a go. And I've gone through those. I look through those four figures that I can use in my digital montaging. And when I started to do the In the Rooms series, they were the same people I was using. In fact, some of them are repeated in my montages and in the photographs, the pinhole photographs. And then about 9 months ago, when AI suddenly hit the news, I thought, well, as an art teacher, I'm going to have to find out what this is, because students are undoubtedly going to start bringing me AI produced art.
And they're going to know more than you if you're not careful.
Yeah, absolutely. So I looked into it and I thought, well, there's some free text to image generators. I'll try them. And if anyone's never tried them, essentially what you do is you type in a line of text and it generates images based on that line. So I, you know, because of the project I was doing, I started to type in things like man standing full length in a 1930s suit and hat, black and white, film noir, weeping into his hands. So I type that in, and then you wait for like a minute, and then a bunch of images come up. And that's kind of just led me down a bit of a rabbit hole. I mean, it is a fascinating thing, you know, to see these images appear, and then to think, where are they coming from? And to think about all the different doors that it opens and all the different questions that it raises about those figures and about, you know, as far as I understand it, obviously they're accessing a massive archive, just like I am with my magazine archive. They're accessing a massive archive of already taken photographs that belong to somebody. But again, I'm taking images from magazines without thinking about that.
Yeah. And you're using snippets of people's lives from the past, aren't you?
There's
all sorts of really interesting philosophical thought processes that are going through my head. I mean, I remember when we had Tina Rowe on the show, and she folks have heard me, if you haven't listened to that show, go and listen to it. So Tina picks up found objects like oyster shells. She does other things, but I like the idea of oyster shells on the London seashore. And then she finds found photographs, you know, like you do, photographs of people that she's no idea who they are. And she, in the darkroom, she then coats the shells with liquid emulsion and photographs prints onto that surface, so you get a distorted image of people who she doesn't know. It sort of invokes memories, it invokes distortion and thought processes. And, you know, she comes from a transracial adoptee background, and so some of the people there, you know, that she finds the pictures of are trying to deal with that, you know, making sense of that background to her life and stuff. So the fact that you're combining sort of AI generated images, which probably are a basis that of someone has actually made that image in the past. So there was someone shared recently in social media. I don't know if any of you three saw it. Steve McCurry did that picture of the Afghan child, you know, years and years ago. And someone did an AI experiment saying Afghan child, something, you know, like you did, some description. And it came up with a picture so close to that Steve McCurry picture. You know, it wasn't the same. There were some interesting subtle changes to it.
So Gary, so you're creating these images in AI. Are you still printing them out and then photographing them?
Yeah, I'm printing sheets of people and then cutting them out with a scalpel.
You're still going through the process of actually taking the pinhole photo. You're just using AI to create your little stand-up people.
You know, and obviously from my point of view, the practicalities, if I wanted to find a man in a 1930s suit weeping into his hands, I could look through magazines for months and never find anything. You know, so it's got that added aspect of, well, you can start to, you know, push the images towards a certain thing that you're after. You know, but then I did start thinking about who are these people and whether you have the same emotional reaction looking at the images of people, whether you know that they're AI generated, whether they're reminiscent of people. But I certainly am a fan of film noir. And sometimes you see faces coming up and you think, I think I know that actor. You know, they are obviously accessing a database of images. Because I'm writing film noir in my description, that's what they're going to. You know, so it's a fascinating world. I mean, I'd also say 95% of the people I get, when I type something in saying a man, 95% of them are white men, hardly ever any other races. When I type in a man, they're all typically 30-something. When I type in women, they're all typically 20-something. They all look like models. You know, it's like, it's kind of, that's another fascinating aspect of it. The prejudices that are steeped in whatever database AI is accessing to come up with these images. But I know, I don't know which rabbit hole I'm going to disappear down. All I know what I've been doing with these images, I've been thinking about these characters, and I decided to call them Humontages because I thought, well, they are some kind of Frankenstein's monster bashed together, images bashed together of actual people that were alive at some point, and now they've somehow been pulled back into existence by an AI image generator. And I started to wonder in my sort of artistic way, what are they bringing with them? Are they bringing any memories with them? Are they bringing any consciousness with them? And I know that the answer is no, you know, but at the same time, for me, it's an interesting concept to think about these poor beings that are being thrown back into the world with too many fingers or too many arms or too many legs, you know, which is quite often what happens when you generate these figures. You know, there's one of the pictures, the one that I use for the In the Room is like a man looking down very sadly into a mirror, circular mirror, you know, and I've looked at that image a lot. He's got very obviously six fingers on it. And
that's because he comes from the Fens.
I know, that's what people said, wasn't it? You know, and I look at him and I think, well, you know, I get, you know, I've looked at myself in a mirror thinking about physical imperfections. I think everybody probably has. You know, I think there's still an emotional impact looking at that figure. There's still a story being told, a narrative being told that can engage an audience. Does it matter that it's a piece of cardboard? Does it matter that it's an AI figure? Does it matter that that face keeps coming up? Quite often when I type in things, that face keeps coming up. It must be some kind of mashed up face of actors, I suspect, in the 1930s and 40s movie industry.
You can just see students of photography and art taking these ideas and running with it creatively, that's the word, can't you? You know, in terms of thesis and PhDs and concepts for projects.
Yeah.
I think one of the important parts of the AI or the images that you've got here is that none of these are famous people. I mean, because if you were to look at the person and say, oh, that's Humphrey Bogart, or hey, that's Marilyn Monroe, that completely would take you out of what you're trying to do with the photo.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And when I'm making digital montages, I always avoid people that you know, people would readily recognize. You know, so I do that deliberately.
I think when you look at them, you know, the people, there was a bit of, as you say, the pitchforks kind of thing over this, because people didn't understand. It created a reaction, and that's what art's supposed to do. It's supposed to create an emotional reaction in people. And if you can't understand it, you go, "What? How can you possibly do this? This makes no sense to me." And people start a debate, which... it's what great art does, you know, and it's purest form. If you look at something and you have nothing to say about it, then what is the point of doing it?
Yeah, no, I agree, yeah.
So it should stimulate a heated debate, especially if it's something that they have no comprehension of prior to that moment in time, which would say it's like brand spanking new to them and everybody else that's seen it, which is brilliant.
Yeah, well, it certainly ticks all those boxes. What's next then, Gary? So you're continuing this project? Is this ongoing? Are you branching off is it opening other avenues? Have you got still mile? Are you going to hone this project into certain themes or?
Yeah, I don't really know. I don't think I've finished with it. No. I think I've still got more things to investigate. I mean, at the very bottom of the page, there's a couple of pictures I took last week where I used a Kodak Ensign full view.
Was that the guy on his, the chap on the chair?
Yeah. You know, and that was, I decided to turn the camera into a pinhole and I took it all apart and made it a pinhole. And then the little one element glass lens looked so lovely. I thought, I think I'll put that back in.
Mm-hmm.
So I put it back in. So it's a pinhole camera with a one element lens in it. And I just like using the camera. It's so nice to look down into the bright view behind that it has. So
there's various versions of the full view, but the one you've got is one with like the big glass mirror thing on top, isn't it?
Yeah. And so I took a film at that last week, and that made me start thinking about maybe doing some more with that camera. But I've got other ideas for the room itself and for what I might want to say with the room. I mean, it's always a kind of, I'm just sort of, you know, the work's got to push the meaning rather than the meaning comes first and then you try and make the work. That's my experience. You know, I don't really know what I'm doing until it's happened. And then I can look back and think, right, I think I know what I was probably subconsciously thinking about when I was making these works. So I still feel like it's an itch that's got a lot of scratching to go. Absolutely. I'll carry on doing it, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Any final questions, gentlemen, for Gary? Or observations?
No, I'm good. I thought I like what I see here. And, you know, I think the, you know, the people who saw the AI stuff who probably got scared of it, you know, the fact that, you know, what I would have loved to have seen is the picture, a non-pinhole version of that picture next to the pinhole version of the picture, because I think the pinhole photography is really what makes the whole image come together. And, you know, to have seen all the different pieces in, you know, like the normal light would have been interesting.
Well, I think, Gary, you did share an image eventually, didn't you, of, of the setup?
Yeah, I shared one. I mean, every now and then on my phone, I take a picture of what I'm doing just because I like to keep records of things. So I did share one of those on the group.
I'll have to go look for it.
It was actually the picture. There's a picture of a woman dancing on a bed. You know, the one that somebody said, why is she making no imprint on the bed?
Okay. Well, we said we weren't going to dwell too much on the controversy. Okay,
fair enough.
So let's gloss over that. John, final observations.
Yeah, just keep doing it. You know, I'm sure you will. We don't need us to tell you, but just keep pushing the boundaries there, man. You know, it's just, it's made me look and then look and look again. At this, it's just, I love it. You know, I don't think I could ever do it myself. It's not what I do, but it's just brilliant to see things that are so different to what you see.
Yeah, it is.
Thank you. Very kind.
Yeah, well done.
Thank you. Top marks. So, folks who want to look at your work, Gary, just your website. I say just your website, owensphoto.org. That's the place.
Yeah, that's the easiest place to see things. I mean, I have a Instagram, which is just Owen's Photo, you know, and people can see the work there, but it's obviously a lot more jumbled up.
And you've got some prints for sale there as well. Are they?
Yeah.
A lot of digital montage stuff. Is that what they are?
It's mostly the digital montage. That's mostly what people have asked me for in the past.
But I love them. I've just seen these for the first time. I've just clicked onto that thing about shop.
Yeah. It's very kind of you. And I'd like to say, I forgot to say earlier, Andrew, that when I was in lockdown, one day I was on Spotify and I thought, I wonder what happens if you put pinhole into the search bar of Spotify. And what came up was the Lensless podcast. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that anyone would have a podcast about pinhole photography.
Mm-mm.
And
well, we weren't the first. There was another one.
Really?
So there's about eight. If you search for Alex, a former guest on the show, Alex Yates, some others, I forget who they all were now. There was a lady in Australia, there was a transatlantic worldwide coming together of folks, and it was called the Pinhole Photography Podcast or something.
Right.
And there's about eight episodes of it, and I think they didn't really have an idea of where to take it next. And I think trying to get everyone together was a bit like herding cats, you know. Whereas I think Curry when he started it with Mark back then, Mr. Snaps, who's a mate of yours, Michael, isn't he?
Yes.
When they started it, I think they first...
No, that mark is off in Hawaii. That's a different mark.
Oh, is that a different mark?
Yeah, the three-eyed monster mark. That's the one that's the starter.
Right, okay. Mr. Snaps or someone else.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah, so Mark, who started it with Corey, they did about 5 or 6 episodes. And they might have had guests, I don't know, but we certainly really realized that the only way we could carry on was to just, you know, feed the show with different creative people, really, because there's only you can't just rock up and talk about pinhole photography every week with just the same people. You know, you need really inspiring people like the work you're doing, Gary, to spark interest. And I think the Facebook group and the podcast work really well together and feed off each other, you know.
Yeah, it's just an amazing resource. You know, you were talking earlier about how do you learn, and I did actually binge listen to all of your episodes, probably in a one lockdown. But what an education, you know. I mean, to listen to all those different pinholers talk about all the different different techniques they use and different equipment. You know, I learned so much that I didn't know about pinhole and about photography. You know, so you know, thanks for putting this podcast out, because it's been a fantastic thing. I think, you know, certainly for me it has been.
Yeah, well, I've enjoyed doing it over the years, and you know, my two reprobate colleagues are going to be hanging around, I think, for a bit. If they want to, so they can carry on contributing.
Yeah, we've brought the standard of the show right up, Andrew. You know, and we're reprobates. You know. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, look, Gary. Are you on any other socials that folks can find you on?
No, it's pretty much mostly just Instagram and the website.
So Instagram is also Owen's Photo, is it?
Just Owen's Photo, one word. Yeah.
Okay. Gary, thank you for coming on. It's been a real pleasure. Pleasure. Keep sharing. Keep doing what you're doing, as John said. Keep sharing stuff into the group, because it's just wonderful, and I love it. And I'm going to go and remind myself about the work of Greta Stern.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on, and well, you know, in a few years' time, we'll see where your projects are gone, and no doubt we'll speak again. Gentlemen, right. Thanks as ever to transatlantic and Scottish colleagues.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. Right.
And thanks for listening, everybody. So you all three of you can say goodbye to the world. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, all.
Bye. See you later.
Yeah. Till next time.